All Buddhas and all sentient beings are nothing but the one mind, beside which nothing exists. It is that which you see before you. Begin to reason about it, and you fall into error. Nevertheless, you can reason from it, from the one mind. You can reason from the mind of enlightenment. If a master asks you the question, "Is there a straw dog at the center of the universe?" how will you answer? Right or wrong? Or will you be able to answer at all? Can you reason from the mind of enlightenment? Regarding the master's question, "Is there a straw dog at the center of the universe?" whoever understands the nature of mind can answer, and any answer given will be correct. But whoever does not understand the nature of mind cannot answer correctly, no matter what they say. Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment, to friends, ex-friends, friends to come, students and allies, and self-declared enemies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 15th of January, 2014. This is Nav Briefing number 105. May the righteous be damned. I open this briefing with a brief citation by memory from a 10th century Chan master, Huang Po. Chan, C-H apostrophe A-N, or sometimes spelled without the apostrophe, is the Chinese variant of the word Zen. And in fact, Zen, which primarily took root in Japan, originated in Chan, in the Chinese schools of non-attainment, which came to flower in the Tang Dynasty. And these schools of non-attainment are exemplified by such Chan masters as Hui Hai and Huang Po. So there is a book which can still be found today, one of the oldest books in my collection, in the Ambergain Trust, The Zen Teaching of Huang Po. That book begins, stunningly I might say, with the first three lines I cited. And after that, I indulged in a little jazz-like, jam-like, free improvisation on the subject of the Buddha mind, which is the ordinary mind. But of course, you may have heard the answer to that question. What is the difference between Buddhas and sentient beings? Have you ever heard that question? Have I put that question before on a briefing? I don't know. Sentient beings is the jargon in Buddhist texts for those human animals who have not realized the Buddha nature of their own minds. So the question, which goes along nicely with this opening dissertation, the question, what is the difference between Buddhas and sentient beings, has been answered by the Chan masters in this way. Well, sentient beings simply can't see that difference. And to Buddhas, it's not there. This is the flavor of non-attainment teaching, and I'd like to bring a little of that flavor to the NAV briefings now and then, off and on, as this great experiment, this beautiful and thrilling experiment, transpires toward the moment of correction. You know, I've spoken about, no, I've declared, let's put it honestly, I've declared that to a tantrika, emotions are just handles. And speaking in the first person, I said, I will use an emotion as a handle to reach someone, and I don't care what handle it is, as long as I reach them. When I received the term of Gaia Awakening in 2008, I was, of course, totally shattered and turned inside out in more ways than one. During the time that I received the term, or during about 8 solid months, I found myself in a state of manic excitement, in a blaze of Dakini instruction. And now I'm back there again in that blaze, but in another way. I'm inserted in quite a tender way in the blaze right now. But looking back at that time 5 years ago, when I saw my humanity stripped away, as if you would flay flesh off the bones of an animal, I really questioned what would come next in human relations, or would I ever have any human relations again? When Kali removes the illusion of compassion, that is a big, big release. And I thought, how can I relate to anyone, in any way, now that I've been liberated from the illusion of compassion? And I came to that moment in my life with a powerful determination for one thing and one thing only. I made a vow to myself, and I said to myself, no matter what happens, no matter what becomes of me, if I never have another human relationship again, I'm still living on the earth with other human animals. As long as I am alive in this body, I am determined to do one thing, to reach other human animals in naked honesty. And to speak brutally and candidly, I don't care what it takes to reach them. Emotions are just handles. It's as if there is a pasta machine in front of me on the table, and I have in my hands a ball of pasta dough. Let's say that is the soul of another human animal. Your soul is a ball of pasta dough to me. So I put the pasta dough in the pasta machine, but it doesn't have a handle on it. So I'm sitting there looking at it. But luckily, I have a well-equipped kitchen. And so over here to my right, on this large formica surface, is an assortment of handles in different sizes and different shapes. And I take a look at these handles, and I see that they are conveniently labeled. One of the handles is labeled sweetness. Another one is labeled humor. There's admiration. There's contempt. There's anger. There's gratitude. There is let's say, sarcasm. It's true that sarcasm, properly speaking, is not an emotion. But sarcasm, when expressed, carries a certain kind of emotion and provokes emotion. So sarcasm is a handle, as well as tenderness. So I look at this assortment of handles, and then deliberately, and quite by choice, I pick up one. I fasten it to the pasta machine. Let's say it's the handle of admiration. And I crank the soul of that human animal. And out comes the pasta produced by the emotion of admiration. A certain shape of pasta. And then I take that crank off. And I wait a while. And I look at the selection and I find another handle that attracts me. Let's say anger. So I hook the handle of anger to the pasta machine, and I crank the human soul with the emotion of anger, and out comes a different size and shape of pasta. And this is how to reach human beings, in a tantric style of ruthless caring. Now, I could devote an entire talk to this subject. Emotions as handles. It's a subject that relates closely to a subject to which I know you out there respond very keenly. The subject of the transmutation of the five poisons in the five skull crown instruction of Miss Piggy. Vajrayogini. Varahi, Dorje Phagmo, or Tantra Mother. And so, it's something to look forward to, and I'd really enjoy that. But for right now, it's my pleasure to demonstrate cranking the pasta machine with the handle of dispassion. You don't hear much about dispassion, do you? You don't hear much about it in Buddhist teaching, as far as I can tell. And even in the general run of daily affairs, well, dispassion is not a word that comes up very often. You hear a lot about compassion and the desire to achieve compassion and the presumption of compassion. You don't hear much about the illusion of compassion. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're hearing that from yours truly in a rather unique way. But what about dispassion? What if I put that handle on the pasta machine and crank your soul? What kind of shape, what shape and size of pasta does that produce? Dispassion is a warrior attribute. And dispassion is the emotion that a warrior exhibits in those instances and moments when the fiery passion of the warrior is left to float. It just floats. It's not abandoned or denied, but it just floats rather than being directed via words or actions toward a particular situation or a particular person. And the tone of dispassion is extremely important in relating and communicating and discussing certain matters. And I've come to realize since the last briefing, pristine and copacetic, that the tone of compassion would be the best way to handle, nudge, nudge, get my reference, the subject that I am undertaking in this briefing. And what is that subject? Well, listen clearly. That subject is the presumption that you can act in a righteous way toward other people, either other individuals one-on-one, or socially to the group, or collectively, to the world at large, to humanity at large. the presumption that you can act in a righteous way. Did it ever occur to you that you have that presumption? Did it ever occur to you that that presumption might be operating in you automatically in such a way that you don't notice it? Well, maybe it hasn't occurred to you, and maybe you haven't noticed it. So let's see if the syntax I can give you would bring you to that observation. The presumption that you can act in a righteous way means, translated, the presumption that you can control the impression you make on others, so that you are satisfied and safe with the manner in which they respond to you. Let me say it again, a little differently. The presumption that you can act righteously, that you can behave in a righteous way, means that you presume that you can control how others receive and perceive your actions and words, to the extent that you are content with their reactions. This being so, in this course of behavior which you undertake, you would receive from others the confirmation that you are controlling the way you affect them. That is righteousness. Did it ever occur to you in the first place that you wish to control the way that others react to you? Well, perhaps not in that particular language. Perhaps the thought crossed your mind one day that you would like to be liked, that you would like to be considered as a nice person and not offend anyone, and that you would like the way that you behave toward others to be acceptable. Maybe that thought crossed your mind one day, and consequent to that thought, your mind went to work on a strategy of how to achieve that particular objective. Now, all of this may have happened in your subconscious, and it might even be happening in your subconscious right now as an ongoing process of behavioral adaptation that you make in the presence of others so that you get from them confirmation of the sense that you control how they perceive and receive you. Wouldn't that be lovely? Oh, wouldn't that be fine? Oh, happy day. And since it may appear to work, this strategy of behavior, this strategy of righteousness, since it may appear to work, it might never have occurred to you to apply a little bit of critical self-scrutiny. Because were you to do so, even a little self-scrutiny might reveal that the real motive behind your desire to act in a nice and acceptable way is control. That's the motive. Control of the way that others respond to you. Now, if you can sink your teeth into any of that, and if you can allow just for a moment the Buddhi in your brain to break through into conscious revelation, then you might consider this. You might consider what I would call, in tantric jargon, the inverse of behavioral self-management. What is the inverse of the determination to control the way that you are perceived and received by others? Consider it for a moment. I propose to you that the inverse would be total releasement of control of how you affect any other human being, either individually, in a social group, or even how you affect humanity at large, if indeed such an effect is conceivable. And I would point out, before I go any further in this pretty little discourse, that it is indeed conceivable that you, one human animal, by the way you behave, the way you talk and act, could have an effect upon the entire human race in the very moment that you enact it. In fact, there is a saying from the works of Jean-Paul Sartre. Now, I can't quote it exactly, but I'll give you a close paraphrase. This is an adage or axiom of existentialism, and it goes like this. When you act, when you do anything or say anything, proceed as if the eyes of all humanity were upon you and humanity were guiding itself by what you do. Now, that's a catchy thought. That's a nifty little snippet of existentialist wisdom that you might consider sometime, now and then. For instance, consider it in the morning when you're having your first cup of tea or coffee. Mull it over a few times. Dedicate a few minutes to phrase and rephrase that proposition in your mind. I'm going to call that proposition Sartre's bet. It's a bet. Let's suppose it's a bet. Let's put Sartre's proposition into the frame of a gaming metaphor. So we'll call it a bet. And let's just say that this is the bet that people make when they decide to become existentialists. They make the bet that the world would change for the better if people acted in the way Sartre describes in this proposition. How do you like that bet? Do you want to bet on that proposition with me? Suppose that you, a human animal, acted in that way in your interaction with other individual animals and, most significantly, in your social interaction. Because you know, speaking existentially and speaking realistically, the only concrete interactions that you have are with individuals and with social groups, and never really with the herd. You might be out there with the herd. You might be at a football stadium. You might be at a concert. A jazz concert in Lausanne, Switzerland, for instance. You might be in some place where there is a gathering of several thousand people, but you're not really interacting with a crowd that large. So in the nature of human experience, you can interact within certain limits. You can interact one-on-one, or person to tribe, if you will, person to family, person to community. And that's about as big as it gets. You cannot interact within the entirety of the human species, but hold on for a moment. Nevertheless, there is a kind of trajectory, implied in Sartre's proposition. Because he does indeed say all of humanity, doesn't he? Well, let's stop and consider for a moment how that could be. Now, I'll adopt the first person simply because, for purposes of illustration, it's easier to speak in this way, and I hold it to be more effective. I can interact one-on-one with other human animals. I can do that with the presumption that I will affect them in some way. I can interact with a small group of human animals, or people, as conventionally called. Imagine the situation of a dinner party. Imagine some kind of small tribal gathering. Or imagine that I live in a relatively small community of 40 or 50 people. In that case, I would generally be able to interact with the whole community, and my words and my actions might indeed be able to affect the whole community. And so I can safely presume that I can affect other human animals in those different settings. But then it is a huge, huge leap to the notion which is suggested in Sartre's proposition that you could actually speak and act in a way that guides the entirety of the human species itself. Were you to do that, well, then you would be a bodhisattva. Because that's what bodhisattvas do, by definition. Or to be more precise, by the definition that I'm now proposing for the Kalika War Party. So let's say that in this party, which is the post-reset expression of the Gaian navigation experiment, all the members would agree that Sartre's proposition defines the action of a bodhisattva. And we would have a consensus in the party that we are all laying down stakes on Sartre's bet. And you can guess what those stakes are. Would you say staking your life? Well, that's perhaps a little bit grandiose. What are the stakes that you put down when you join the bet, when you join the consensus behind Sartre's proposition? It's perhaps a little bit presumptuous to say, I stake my life on it. How about if you stake your reputation on it? How about if you stake your self-image on it and your sense of self-respect? How about that? Now, in the remainder of this briefing, as I continue slowly to crank the handle of dispassion and grind out pasta from the lump of the human soul, I'd like you to consider really closely with me the question of what I have called behavioral adaptation. Actually, I said adaption, but that is really not the word. Adaptation. Behavioral adaptation. What is behavioral adaptation? Well, actually, it's a definition of how you behave. You don't just behave in the world. No human animal just behaves. The behavior of all human animals, just like the behavior of non-human animals, whether they be ladybugs or lizards or elephants, exhibits constant adaptation. There is no behavior without adaptation. So, when you as an individual act or interact one-to-one with another human animal, or when you interact with a group, you are manifesting behavioral adaptation. Now, what are the dynamics of behavioral adaptation? Well, let's look at two fundamentals, which are absolutely inescapable because they are connected with the survival of the human animal. Some time ago in a briefing, I referred to Alice Miller, the Swiss psychologist who wrote The Drama of the Gifted Child, and I described her, I believe correctly, as the foremost child advocate in the world during the time she was alive. I maintain that claim continues to this day based on the contribution of Alice Miller to our understanding of child psychology in such books as The Drama of the Gifted Child, For Your Own Good, and The Untouched Key. Now, Alice Miller was a pioneering child psychologist. I would argue that she stands absolutely in a class by herself. Nevertheless, some of the concepts and interpretations you find in Alice Miller resonate closely with other concepts, with concepts in other schools of child psychology. I think primarily of the so-called object relations school, which is said to have been founded by Anna Freud in one respect, Freud's daughter, but actually was developed cogently and in a most instructive way by psychologists such as John Bowlby and others. Also, Alice Miller's insights on the behavior of children and the needs of children in the preverbal stage mirror closely the astounding discoveries of developmental psychologist Daniel Stern in his book, The Interpersonal World of the Infant. So I'm referring, without being academic and tedious about it, I would like to refer here to a considerable and impressive body of clinical and developmental psychology. Drawing upon my limited knowledge of those materials, I determined that there are two principal factors in the rudimentary dynamics of behavioral management. And these factors go back to the child, the infant human animal, and how it must adapt itself to the world into which it's born so that it can survive. Now, Bowlby and others have pointed out what I consider to be an absolutely indispensable insight about childhood. Every sane human being who shows any concern whatsoever about knowing what it means to be human, who presumes to know what it means to be human, should understand and grasp what I am going to say right now. It is a common requirement of every human animal in infancy, from the preverbal stage going into the verbal stage, that infant should be able to express itself without inhibition and at the same time without fear of losing the love object to whom its expression is directed. Now, the love object, which is a term from object relations psychology with Bowlby and others, the love object is rather, you know, a cold clinical term that refers to something real and vital and vibrant. The human animal as an infant is full of emotions, including the emotion of love. And the emotion of love, in fact, is a primary emotion born innately into the human infant. We are all born filled with love. But that love needs to have an object. It needs to be relational love. So the newborn infant, even before it can speak, even before its neuro and cerebral chemical circuits have configured any kind of language syntax that would define love, hate, attachment, need, even before any of that, the infant needs to make its love relational, and it makes it relational in a love object, which may be the mother, but that does not necessarily have to be. Now, as a child, as an infant, develops, let's imagine the stage where the child begins to stand and walk. Let's imagine the stage where it grasps things, it moves around, it's exploring the world. Let's imagine the threshold that the infant reaches, the infant human animal. Just at the point of beginning to speak, who is able to ask for things, able to name things, and then carry that child forward to the age of 2 or 3, the period that is sometimes called the terrible twos, which can also extend into the age of three. Picture the child at this stage. The child has a number of love objects in its world. It relies on those love objects to survive. It gives its love to those objects as a way of bonding to those other animals who will then provide for it. Therefore, it adapts itself in that way to survival. At the same time, as the child develops through the preverbal period, across that threshold into the verbal period, there is a veritable explosion of emotional reactions in the child who is vividly and recklessly exploring the world around it. Therefore, the child at that stage, that particular stage, really needs the assurance that if it explodes into any kind of emotional expression toward the love object, it will not lose the love object in doing so. Well, can you get the picture here? Alice Miller, developmental psychologist, and objects relations psychologist, who all concur on the fact that if the child is not able to rage and be reckless and express particularly anger and other objectionable emotions, other difficult emotions, and have the safety of knowing that it will not risk losing the love object in doing so, lacking that safety, the result is catastrophic. And the initial conditions of infancy at that point set up a situation for catastrophe and emotional disaster in the remainder of the life of the child. Can you see that? Likewise, in the initial conditions of those early years, when the retention of the love object is so critical, the pattern is set for the future dynamics of what I'm calling behavioral adaptation in the life of that human animal. The pattern is set in the way that I'm describing. And so the human animal evolves into being a social animal quite early on by learning how to behave. Have you ever heard that phrase before? Children must learn how to behave. And so behavioral adaptation, which is a matter of survival for the infant, gradually merges into what I call behavioral self-management. So children learn manners. They learn how to behave. They learn how not to do things that would be objectionable to the love object, parents, or to anyone else in the field of the love object by implication, by inference, by association. If they offend or disturb anyone else in the environment of human contacts, that is tantamount to disturbing their relation to the parent. So children grow up learning to behave. And gradually, what I'm calling the behavioral adaptation of the infant morphs into what is known as the need for approval. So every child, after a certain age, especially gliding into adolescence and into the teen years, faces a critical adaptation of behavior. Everything that concerns the life of a teenager rests on the question of approval or disapproval by the peer group and by the world at large. And generally speaking, human animals learn to behave in such a way that they can be relatively sure that they will get approval for their behavior. They learn to control the way they affect others. They learn, as I said, quoting the exact words, to seek from others the confirmation that you are controlling the way you affect them. And when that happens, everything is fine. Life goes on, and people get along in the social dramas and social situations that arise for human animals. Now, there's one other aspect of this process of behavioral adaptation, which then morphs into self-management, which I need to mention briefly. It has been designated by the term impression management. Now, impression management is an important strategy of human behavior, no question about that. And there are instances where impression management is useful, and in some cases even absolutely imperative. In the first instance, for example, a simple case that comes to mind is I'm a teenage girl of 14, and I'm going to a new school for the first time. I'm showing up in the class, showing up in the auditorium or in the lunchroom, and I practice impression management because I want the other kids to like me and I want to fit in. Another obvious example is going for a job interview. If I'm some 40-year-old man who's been working in advertising and I lost my job 5 years ago and now I'm 40 and I have a rare opportunity to maybe get a place in an advertising agency, you can be sure that I pay extremely close attention to the impression that I make to everyone in that agency, including the secretary at the receptionist desk and every other person I encounter. And when I sit down for my job interview, I am practicing the art of impression management. Well, obviously, this is a necessary form of behavior in human society, and in some cases, your life may depend upon it. There are some places in the world, some neighborhoods in L.A., for instance, that I've driven through on my way from LAX Airport back to the Hollywood Hills where I used to live. And I can guarantee you that if my car had broken down, or the car of my friend who came to pick me up at LAX had broken down at 11 o'clock at night in certain areas of LA, and we found ourselves standing out on the street and encountering some of the local denizens of that neighborhood, you can be damn sure that we would have to practice some very good impression management if we were going to get out of that situation alive. So there is something to impression management. I wouldn't put it down, and I wouldn't say it's entirely unnecessary. Of course it isn't. But let me ask you this. Picture the 40-year-old man who hasn't worked for 5 years. He has a wife and 3 children, finally has a job interview, and it's the morning of the job interview. Picture him in the kitchen, sitting there with his wife of 15 years, sitting there with his 3 children, having his breakfast, and taking a little time with his family before he gets in his car to go to his interview. Now, you know that at the interview, and even at the very scene of the interview, he's going to be rigorously practicing impression management, right? He's going to be rigorously attempting to control the way others receive and perceive him by what he says and does, or even by the way that he just stands and looks, by the way that he stands and looks in the waiting room while he's waiting to be called up for this interview. So there's no question that he will practice impression management, but I ask you, don't you think he's practicing impression management sitting at the kitchen table with his wife and kids? The difference is that he doesn't realize that he's practicing impression management with his family, because it involves a kind of behavioral self-management that goes way back into childhood and has a long adaptive or maladaptive history behind it. His impression management at the job interview is an assumed behavior, conscious and intentional. What the man does not know is that his behavior with his family is likewise an assumed behavior of impression management. Of course, I'm talking about a man at the kitchen table with his family who's doing his human best to fulfill the role of a good father. So it might seem rather harsh of me, it might seem rather brutal of me, to accuse him of assumed behavior. Well, in fact, the way that he behaves is not exclusively assumed behavior. Of course, there is something genuine in his behavior as a father interacting with his wife and children at the table. Of course, there are genuine and unmanaged expressions coming from the man. It is a both-and situation. The man is both a genuine, loving father responding in a sincere and non-adapted way to his children. He's not responding to his children in order to control the way that he affects them. Not entirely, but to some degree he is, because that is the learned behavior that we all have from childhood. And within that learned behavior, going back to the fear of losing the love object, is the primary element that molds self-management in human animals, which is exactly that: fear. Fear of rejection, fear of non-approval, fear of acting in a way that allows others to find fault in the way that you act. And this fear is omnipresent, and it undermines the authenticity of human animals in how they behave among themselves, among each other. Now, bear in mind that while genuine human emotional expression coexists with behavioral self-management, bear in mind that while it is a both-and situation, no human animal can achieve a pure effect upon other human animals as long as they are unconsciously or subconsciously directed by the fear that their behavior will be rejected or will prove to give offense. So with this word offense, the subject of righteousness returns into view. Stop for a moment and make an inventory of what offends you. Think back to the last time that something offended you. And if you can, try to remember or reconstruct an incident when you interacted with another human animal one-on-one, and that human animal, that person, did something to offend you, and think about how it felt to be offended and why you were offended. Now, offense is a big, big issue in human experience, isn't it? And it's a remarkable fact, and I'm going to digress just slightly with this comment, but I will return rapidly to the main vein here. It's a remarkable fact that there is, among all of the human beings inhabiting this earth, a particular group who are more easily offended and more often offended than any other group of human animals. Do you know what that group is? I'm not going to say it because I'll just let you draw your own conclusions. But if you're thinking what I'm thinking about that group that is so prone to be offended by all the rest of the human race that they almost define their identity by their tendency to be offended, then you might not be surprised to know that the concept of tzaddik or righteousness infects the mentality of those people. Why do I say that? What am I getting at here? Well, how about if I offer a definition of offense for you to consider? It goes like this. There is nothing in this world that really offends a genuine human being. But humans can take offense as a pretext for being righteous. That is what offense is. It's simply a pretext to be righteous. And so, if a human animal has in his or her psychic and emotional disposition the factor of tzaddik or righteousness, then that human being will tend to be offended. But by contrast, a human animal who is free from tzaddik cannot be offended by anything. Now, having made that statement, I admit that's a rather outrageous statement. And I know, as I sit here, slowly cranking the handle of dispassion, that I really need to qualify that statement on 2 points. By not being offended by anything, I don't mean that a human animal, free of tzaddik, would accept what anyone else does. For instance, if I am sitting in a park and I see someone beating an animal or beating their child or exhibiting some form of abuse, that I would just let it go by because I'm not offended. That's not what I mean by being offended. There are many things that human animals do that are entirely unacceptable. And so a human animal, and more specifically, a calico warrior who is free of zaddik, will not be offended, but a calico warrior will hold certain human actions and expressions to be objectionable and unacceptable. That is the first qualification. And the second qualification is to be offended and to have your feelings hurt are not exactly the same thing. So a human animal who is free of offense can also have their feelings hurt. But in such a case, that animal would not consider it to be an offense as such. It is just something that happens between human beings. Again, to use the first person for way of illustration, if you hurt my feelings, if you say something insulting about me, or defame my character, or make some comment about me, showing that you don't like me, or that you find me to be unattractive, or stupid, or devious, whatever you might say about me, it could hurt my feelings, especially if it were not true. But in another way, if it were true. But either way, having my feelings hurt by you is not like taking offense. Having my feelings hurt by you is a risk I take in relating to you. Period. And if I were to come to my relationship with you with a subversive and covert attitude of righteousness, such that I assumed that you could not be allowed to hurt my feelings because I would be offended and therefore put in a position of righteousness toward you, I sabotage beforehand the possibility of any realistic, genuine experience in which you and I, as two human animals, can actually reach each other. If I'm going to reach you, and you're going to reach me, and we're open to that proposition, then there is always the risk that feelings will be hurt. But hurt feelings are a reality of the impact of one human animal upon another. Offense is a presumption. It's a presumption about the impact we have on each other. And it is a false and distorting presumption fed by fear that drives human beings into the trap of righteousness. Now, what I'd like to say, and I want to see if I can't say it, in the remaining 15 minutes of this talk, is simply this. I would like to tell you emphatically that as much as you may want to be a bodhisattva and stake your self-image on Sartre's bet, you just can't do it as long as you have zaddik operating in your psyche. Because the presence of zaddik in the psychic, emotional, mental, and perceptual field of a human being spoils the capacity for genuine behavior and genuine interaction with any other human beings. Those of you who follow my writings and my talks know that I consider the theme of zaddik very closely in my book, Not in His Image. And I'm proud to say that I've put a number of words into the syntax of the collective discourse on this planet at the dawn of the 21st century. I've put in the word salvationist, sophianic, telestic, archon and archontics, recently celestics. And this is what I do. I'm happy to do these things. It's my work. It's the part of my vocation where the Nahual converges with the teacher. And so I teach the syntax to steady the understanding of what it means to be human. And I'm happy to say that I've introduced the word Zadok and Zadokite in the perspective of Gnosticism. The Gnostic warning about the Zadok principle and the Zadokite cult of the ancient Hebrews is really top, you know. It's really an imperative warning to the human species. But up until now, you may have regarded Zadok or Zedek and all of my exposition regarding that subject as having a kind of quaint historical value. It refers, of course, to the priests of Zadok, to the whole Zadokite order in pre-Christian times, and then again as it manifested in the Dead Sea sect in Qumran and so forth and so on. But maybe until now, it never occurred to you that it's not just some minute splinter sect of the ancient Hebrews who carry Zadok. You carry it too. We all carry it. And if we didn't all carry it in ourselves, then it would not be possible for those who make a supremacist ideology out of Zadok to have the advantage they have gained. It would not be possible for them to have committed the massive atrocities on this planet that they have committed. And it would not be possible for them to exert their influence and power over all those members of the human species who do not belong to their self-designated tribe. You have to ask yourself, how could the Zadokites and their accessories come to have achieved such power? Well, the answer is because you're not facing the Zadok in you. And unless you do, you cannot be an effective human animal reaching other humans. And unless you can reach other humans, you cannot affect the changes that would bring about a better way of life on this planet. And unless you can reach other humans in naked honesty, you cannot act as a bodhisattva who guides the entire human species by the way that he or she acts and speaks. Zadok is the great impediment. Zadok is the spoiler, and it is the tool of the spoilers. And we, every single one of us, including the one speaking, are spoiled and corrupted by the righteousness that conceals itself in the tendency to be offended. Now, let me make it crystal clear in concluding here that I do not demand or expect or anticipate human beings in society at large to even consider behavior free of righteousness and offense. That proposition is not an everyday proposition, my friends. It's not a proposition I would make to the man in the street or the woman in the changing room. It's a proposition made to Calico warriors. And it goes like this. If you want to be in the warrior party, you need to consider that an offense is acceptable. In the warrior party, we follow a code. There's a name for that code, and I'm close to putting the name on it right now as I speak. And in the warrior code, there is a consensus, there's an agreement, there's a pact. We in the warrior party assume among each other a freedom that we cannot assume in society at large. Don't ever think you can go out with this code of behavior of the Calico Warriors and demonstrate it in society at large. Well, you can if you want to, but it's likely to cause you some considerable grief and some extremely unpleasant and negative reactions. But remember what I said about the child's need to be able to express emotions that risk the loss of the love object without actually losing the love object. None of us had that problem resolved in our childhood. I can guarantee you. I can make a generalized statement. I know that generalizations are dangerous, but I'll stand by this one. Not one single one of you hearing my words had that condition of safety provided in childhood. But I tell you, you can have it now. That condition of safety is provided in the Calico War Party by our consensus that no matter how or how much we may offend each other and hurt each other's feelings, we get over it together and we get copacetic. That is a triumph within the war party. That is the first triumph of our battle, that we do no longer allow division and alienation and turn against each other out of righteousness. The triumph of wild, free, uninhibited, uncensored self-expression. This is what you have in the Calico War Party. And if you don't have it, if we don't have it in the party, then we don't have a party. It's as simple as that. You might recall that I said that coming through the months when I received the Terma of Gaia Awakening, I found myself facing a truly terrible, terrible realization. The illusion of compassion was stripped from me as if my flesh had been stripped from my bones while I was still alive. And I faced the possibility that I might never be able to enter into another human relationship again. Intimate relationship with a woman, friendship, or any kind of acquaintance. I faced that terrible realization, and I lived for months in a desolating loneliness. But in that desolation, one thing never varied, and that was my determination to reach another human animal, no matter at what cost, just to reach someone. You see, this is it. This is the secret. This is the challenge of a bodhisattva. Just to reach another human being in naked honesty, free of righteousness, and liberated from the illusion of compassion. As you hear those words, I can't imagine what you think or how you respond. but I do not know how I could say it any better. I do not know any other way to introduce the code of the Calico Warrior, which is the code of non-offense. It does not mean that you do not offend anyone. On the contrary, you are free to offend within the Calico War Party, just as a 2 or 3 year old child is free to scream and rage and do anything it likes and express itself in any way it likes. And now, yes, now, right now, here and now, in this emergent human reality, the child does that without the fear that it will lose the opportunity to be loved, or lose the opportunity to love in the ways that suit its innate disposition. For some of you, when that moment happens, face to face with another member of the Calico War Party, another devotee of Planetary Tantra, when that moment happens, you may realize that it is the first time it has ever happened in your entire life. Well, welcome to the party. It's so good to see you at last. It really is. You know, the harm and horror inflicted on this planet by those few human animals who have adapted Zadic righteousness to a principle of supremacy and domination is truly incalculable. And there must be, to compensate that horror against humanity, there must be some action that rights the balance. And it looks to me now that that action that rights the balance is the kind of action described in Sartre's proposition. No matter what you do, when you speak, when you act, even when you stand and look, proceed as if humanity itself were watching your every move and guiding itself by what you do. What if that is where the balance against the horror can be corrected, and the crucial force of rebalance be applied? That's Callie's moment among us. Whether she has her magic moment in the world or not, we'll see soon enough. But this is her magic moment among us. This is when Kali reaches you as if she were another human being reaching you. She is the great liberator. But liberation is a choice. It's not something that comes upon you. It's something that you bring upon yourself. Righteousness is an attitude that conceals the desire to control the way that you affect others, to control the effect you have on them, to control how they receive you and perceive you. Your behavior through your entire life has been distorted by this desire. And even when it appears to succeed, it's purely an illusion. No one can control the way that they affect others. It's purely an illusion. And beyond that illusion, Oh my. Beyond that illusion is her shock of tenderness. When you reach another human being, no matter how, with contempt, humiliation, gratitude, admiration, delight, irony, by teasing, by taunting, the skills of the Bodhisattva are many. And when you reach another human being in naked honesty and allow yourself to be reached, within that impact, if you can dare to invite it and dare to incite it, within that impact is the tenderness of her embrace. Kali, the undefeatable, she who liberates from all illusions, especially the illusion of compassion. So the party is forming. And now, right now, in the Kali shift of January 2014, the warriors stand in the ranks, united by the code of non-offense. And going out from the ranks, you hear the war cry, "May the righteous be damned."